Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Jeanette Ayu, author of Brass, just published in January by Random House. Jeanette's debut was Domesticated Wild Things, which won the Prairie Schooner Prize, and her fiction and nonfiction has been published in the New York Times, Glimmer Train, American Short Fiction, and other publications, and she holds an MFA from the University of North Carolina. She grew up in Waterbury, Connecticut, where Brass is set, lives in Athens, Georgia now, and works as an academic librarian. Brass is the story of a mom and a daughter told from each's perspective and over the passage of time and in an alternating fashion. The city of Waterbury is as much a protagonist as our main characters, and the alternating chapters told from different viewpoints in a number of ways propel us through this book and give us lots to ponder about our cities, our families, our futures. So welcome, Jeanette, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about Waterbury, the brass industry, and I guess in so doing, a little bit about the book.
Sure. The brass industry is really what put Waterbury on the map. It was a little small city for the first kind of, let's say, 100 years of its existence. And then the brass industry started growing and attracting more and more people from more and more places. And so we had these different waves of immigration. Some of the earlier immigrants were Irish and Italian, and then later Lithuanian, Polish, more recently Albanian, a lot of Puerto Rican and Dominican migration there over the past couple of decades. But unfortunately, the brass industry started to leave town beginning in the 60s, and by the 80s, it was pretty much non-existent. And so some of the more recent groups of immigrants who have come haven't been able to find the same type of work that, you know, earlier groups did. And so there really is some economic struggle that's happening there. And I think what makes it unique is not that it's a manufacturing town that has, you know, faced a decline, because there are many of those places in this country, but that it takes place in Connecticut, or that it exists in Connecticut, which is mostly a place that people think of as a very privileged place, and in many ways it is. But along the coastline, you've got those kind of Gold Coast, New York bedroom communities, but much of the state is actually blue-collar and working class, and so I thought it was important that the book be set there, because we don't get to see, I don't think, too much in fiction of people who kind of have a view of the land of plenty, but are struggling to just kind of maintain and do better from where they are.
It reminds me of that song by Billy Joel, Allentown.
Yeah, very much, very much. And I'm not a huge Billy Joel fan, but
me neither.
I actually like that song.
Yeah, I know. I'm not a great fan either, but that song kind of... And We Didn't Start the Fire, I kind of like too, but I wouldn't buy an album.
I don't think he likes that one very much.
So, not to show my ignorance, but what happened to the brass industry? Did it become imports, or?
I think it was a combination of different things. One is that they started, you know, manufacturing in Connecticut, as it did in much of the U.S., moved outside of the U.S. because it was cheaper to produce things elsewhere. But I think in the case of brass in particular, it's just not something that's used as frequently anymore. So things like plastics were replacing things that brass used to be made of, or that brass used to make, such as, you know, cosmetic containers, that kind of thing. You wouldn't go to the drugstore and find a lipstick tube in brass anymore. It's definitely going to be in plastic. So it's just a combination of things, you know, exporting and just a reduction in the material itself in terms of how it's used.
Which kind of goes to the title, because the title you can read in at least two different ways. You know, it's like,
yeah, and. The title is, you know, in one sense, brass endures. It's a very resilient material, and I wanted that to be a part of the name. But also, there's an irony in it, because the city that was built on brass and still in many ways is identified with it, the foundation has basically been removed. And so I think it's a city that's still struggling to kind of retain its identity that it's always held, but also try to find something else to fill the void that brass left.
It was smart of you and your editors, publishers, to shorten a title to just Brass instead of your original title, which I think was the motto of the city or something like that?
Yes, it used to be What Is More Lasting Than Brass, and that was what the working title was forever, and I thought it was very poetic and pretty. And then when my agent actually suggested, when we went out with the book, to just shorten it to Brass, and I was like, that is so much better. It's punchier, it's compact, it's got some power to it, the way that the material itself does, so thank goodness for outside readers.
Yeah, and you know, I own an independent bookstore, and you know, you can say you can't judge a book by its cover as many times as you want, but every single person who walks into my store does. And I think, you know, the title just jumps out at you, and the cover image is really good too. So, and it's on our front table. So,
the cover is something I'm really happy with.
Me too.
And, you know, I wasn't really sure how covers came to be. It was a kind of magical behind the scenes process for me. But, you know, they sent along a bunch, and I think all of us who saw the covers, my editor, my agent, when we saw the image that ultimately became the cover, we knew that was it right away.
Hey, you know, going back to the book, because we're here to sell books, I know Elsie came first. How did that process work that Elsie came first? She was kind of like the main character, and then you brought Lulu Lujetta into the book.
Yeah, so I think literally Elsie started as an exercise in my MFA when I was studying. I think I literally remember being in a class and being told to free write based on a prompt for a few minutes. And the voice that came out was somebody who was really informed a lot by the types of women that I grew up with and went to college with in particular. And I went to a community college, and then I went to a state university after that. And so it was a lot of non-traditional students, a lot of women who were really smart, but had whose earlier lives kind of prevented them from pursuing college at a traditional age, and mostly blue collar, many of them single moms. And so I kind of took their fire and their sass and just kind of distilled it down to a few sentences for this exercise, and then kind of fell in love with it because I didn't see a whole lot of these women. I didn't encounter very many of these types of women in fiction. And so I thought I could pursue that. And as far as Lujetta, well, you know, I had worked on this book for years, and I kind of approached writing it the way that I approach short stories, which was, let's just, you know, start writing it and see what happens. And that doesn't work as well with a novel as it does with short stories. And so I had gone through a couple of drafts, and it was really just going nowhere. It didn't really have much of a shape. And my agent actually asked me, why is Elsie telling the story now, which is kind of an answer that you should have prepared every time you start a project, but I hadn't. And I thought, well, you know, because her daughter that she got pregnant with at this point is probably a young woman herself and is in danger of maybe repeating the same types of cycles. And she said, well, bingo. And so I introduced Lujetta that way. To just get her voice literally to the page so that now there actually is an imperative, with Elsie telling her story.
You know, we touched on it briefly before we started, but and not to interrupt you, but, you know, Elsie is in the first person and her daughter is in the second. And, you know, I listened to that NPR interview, I think, with you. How did that happen? And, you know, it's because it's so hard and unusual and rare to write, you know, in the second person. And sometimes it's kind of clunky, but here it was... it read perfectly.
Sorry, I keep interrupting you. I did resist it for a long time. When I first wrote Elsie, it was always in the first person. I always knew what her voice would be, and it came pretty clear to me from the very beginning. While I definitely had to shape the arc of the story itself, the voice was always there as the engine all along. With Lujetta, I did try writing it initially in the first person, and I found her too maudlin, a little bit too whiny 17-year-old to really endure for the duration of a novel. I tried writing it in the third person, and it just seemed too removed. I didn't really have an emotional connection with her. And so I struggled between those two tenses, really tried working on those for quite a while. In fact, completed entire drafts with both of those voices. And then when those weren't working, as an exercise, I thought, well, let me just write it the way it comes to my head. And you know, the way that it came into my head was in the second person. And I thought, this is terrible, because no one's going to want to read half of a novel that's in the second person. But it ended up really working, and I think the way that I think of it is that Lugeta does not really feel like she has agency over her life, over her decisions. She believes that fate, whether it be the fate of where she was born or to whom she was born, is really getting to determine the shape of her future. And so by putting it in the second person, it was kind of like this outside force was directing her. And it's really just a matter of, like, what is exactly the outside force? Is it, again, the town where she lives? Is it her mother and her mother's secrets and her mother's mistakes? And so I leave that a little bit ambiguous, but I think that, to me, that was the motor that kind of that made that voice feel the most natural to me, even though in a narrative sense it's really kind of an unnatural type of voice to write from.
But it really worked, and, you know, even that first chapter in which Luletta is confronted by this other girl, you know, it was nice having a little distance from that confrontation, and it kind of set it off in a really good way.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, it was also, you know, the parallels between Elsie and Lugeta, the mother and the daughter, are supposed to be really kind of tangible. You can see some of the mistakes that Elsie makes almost being repeated or possibly being repeated in her daughter. But I think that adding the second person also, like you said, gives it that kind of remove and makes it a little bit more analytical, so that maybe things will turn out a little bit different because there is a direction coming from somewhere else.
What about, and you talked briefly earlier, and I know in other interviews you've talked about, too. And in fact, the NPR interview, I think, was right before you went back to do a reading at your hometown. So has the, you know, have you offended some people, or has that been expressed?
Yeah, I have. I'm sure I have. I actually, you know, my reading in Waterbury was wonderful. It was fantastic. There was a really nice turnout, and we had some really great conversations. There was one woman who, at the very beginning of the Q&A, really voiced her displeasure, and it actually turned out great because it became a conversation about the difference between, you know, a first-person narrator and the author's voice, because these characters are expressing, you know, feelings about their city that I, as an author, don't have necessarily. And the other issue was that she hadn't read the book. The book had just come out, and so when you read about the book and kind of, you know, there's a line that has gotten quoted a couple of times where it says something like, "I think Waterbury is the crappiest place on earth," or something like that. And that's coming directly from a line of dialogue. But when you extract it from the context, suddenly it just sounds like I just want to destroy Waterbury and I have a personal vendetta against it. But really what I wanted to do was, you know, if you most people don't really know too much about Waterbury unless you live in the area. But if you Google Waterbury, you'll find all kinds of articles. It's the, you know, bottom of the places ranked or places rated almanac. It's the worst place to live. It's the worst place to do business. And this is, you know, publications that are giving it this designation. And so what I wanted to do was kind of take that narrative that's being constructed kind of in nonfiction stories about Waterbury and then humanize it and say, okay, this is such a terrible place to live. Well, what happens if you do live there? Are you still allowed to have hope? And also, how much of it is really distinct to this place and how much of it is actually kind of other cultural factors around it? Because, you know, in my own personal experience, I can tell you that when I was 17 years old, I couldn't wait to get out of Waterbury. I definitely thought that it was going to be kind of the key to the rest of my life. And then when I left, I realized that I actually didn't feel that different. And the characters kind of go through similar things. When Lugeta actually does leave town, she looks around and she's like, why doesn't anything look different? Why don't I feel different? Because I think there's more to it than just, you know, a place on a map.
And that's one of the things that's interesting is you don't paint these characters or the town as being bad. You know, you one, as many people have remarked, you inject a great deal of humor into it. And secondly, you know, you show the characters, the mother and the daughters, and some of the corollary characters too, as having a great deal of strength.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's absolutely the story of Waterbury too. You know, in terms of hating a place, places are agnostic. You know, they aren't things. They aren't. They don't have feelings about the people who live there. It's really the people who live there that create the feeling for the city, and You know, with a place like Waterbury, there are real struggles, but it's also important to kind of keep perspective. And as the story, begins, they don't really have much perspective. Elsie is the one who says early on, I think this is the crappiest place on earth, and she's talking to someone who grew up in a prison camp in communist Albania. And so he points out, well, that's because you haven't seen anything. And so I think it's important to have these kind of outside perspectives to kind of make you realize that you're not dealing with necessarily a character who is seeing things from a neutral perspective or who has, you know, a great sense of perspective on where she's coming from.
Well, now that since you mentioned it, talk a little bit about Bashkim and how he's the kind of trap that the kind of trap in which Elsie and Lujeta fell into.
So Bashkim, I was actually just thinking about this when I was thinking about kind of some people thinking that I'm scapegoating Waterbury because,
right.
You know, Bashkim comes to Waterbury. It's a place where he already has family, and as is a common story, there are enclaves that are built for different ethnic groups, and they tend to kind of just grow because, you know, you send for cousins, you send for nephews. And for him, it's this fantastic opportunity. This is where he's going to become an American and become wealthy and kind of get to live out the dreams that he wasn't allowed to have as a young man in Albania. Whereas for Elsie, she sees it as a complete dead end. And so they're literally, and they're starting the story and their story together from completely opposite places. And Elsie kind of believes that she understands suffering and can empathize with Bashkim for that reason, but as the story goes on, realizes that she kind of knows very little about him and actually knows very little about the world. and those things are getting to be too difficult to reconcile for them to kind of really make it together as the story goes on. But I think it was interesting for me to kind of, to play with the idea of movement as being responsible for growth in the sense of just literally moving geographically, whether it's to a new country, whether it's to a different state, and what happens when you reach that destination and the dream that you thought would be waiting for you isn't there.
Talk about how, like at the beginning when I said that sometimes the locales are as much a protagonist as anybody else, talk a little bit about the Betsy Ross Diner, since it actually did exist at one point.
It did exist. I spent a lot of time at the Betsy Ross Diner, as many people in the area did. And this was, you know, back in the 90s. Coffee shops weren't really a thing yet. You know, Friends was just hitting the air, and the idea of kind of like a cafe where people gather, which is now so commonplace, everybody has them, whether they're Starbucks or some kind of local cafe. But growing up in Waterbury, and actually throughout the Northeast, I'm sure you have them in the Philly area,
yep,
as well, these diners, which were open 24 hours a day, kind of just became these default, de facto meeting places for all different groups of people. You had teenagers meeting there because the mall was closed, and they just wanted to hang around and drink some coffee and play some Street Fighter in the lobby. You have people who are working overnight shifts who are there on their lunch breaks. And you also have these kind of different ethnic groups because, for the most part, you have people in the kitchen who are working who come from all different places. And in the area where I grew up, a lot of the Greek diners were actually run by Albanians. And so it kind of just became this strange little melting pot that served a practical function in the sense that that's where you're supposed to eat food. But most people just kind of, sat there for hours after their cheese fries had gone cold and just continued conversations because, that was the place that they can meet in public that felt, it felt like there was a vibrancy that you wouldn't get, just meeting in somebody's living room.
Yeah, I had the same experience. I worked at the night shift at the Philco Ford plant making cathode ray picture tubes for old TVs, and I was like the worst worker there. But after work, we used to go to Littleton's Diner where we would have dinner at 3 a.m., and it really became a big part of my life. And so I understood that completely. And you're right, Philadelphia, of course, now they're going away, but had its share of diners, and this was a place that, meant a lot to me. So
And it's funny because I didn't realize that those types of dinos were unique to that region until I left it.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you just don't find, I live in Georgia now, and you just don't, there are diners, but it's not the same type of diner. They're not usually 24 hours. They're definitely not the Greek diner. They're not found in, like, the silver rail cars
right.
that a lot of them were in the Northeast. So I really miss them. So the Betsy Ross Diner actually did go out of business many years ago, and it was replaced for a little while with a different one, but it just never came back to what it was before. But it was just kind of a way for me to resuscitate it and get, you know, spend a little bit more time there since, you know, it's impossible for me to do it in real life.
Yeah, in Georgia you find the Waffle House.
There is a Waffle House.
Which doesn't have
as often as you find a Dunkin' Donuts in Connecticut and many other different parts of the Northeast, you'll find a Waffle House down here.
Well, that was one of the other things about Connecticut and Waterbury. You know, you said, like, when you tell somebody you're from Waterbury, Connecticut, they think you're talking about, you know, this affluent bedroom community of New York, you know? They don't mm-hmm. realize that it's completely different. And I was guilty of the same thing. When I first started reading it and when I thought about Waterbury, I thought, oh, yeah, well, that's a really high-end kind of place where, you know, David Letterman might live before he drives in the morning, something like that.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, again, growing up there, I didn't really realize that people had that perception of Connecticut. And it wasn't until I left that, you know, I felt like every time somebody asked me where I was from and I answered Connecticut, I had to disclaim it and say, but not that Connecticut. Because people only think of Connecticut as one thing, and in reality, it's actually a really diverse place. And like I said before, most of it is actually blue-collar, working-class, or middle-class. It's really just kind of distinct regions that are relatively small compared to the rest of the state that have that kind of extravagant wealth.
If we go back to, like, Waterbury and you go back to domesticated wild things and your writing being kind of located in the same areas, do you think you'll be able to leave Waterbury in your next book or the book after that?
I'm inching my way away from it because I'm working on another manuscript now that is set partly in Waterbury, although the location of that is not nearly as, it doesn't serve as much of a character in that book. And then it's set partly overseas. So I am kind of starting to be able to break away from it. But, you know, part of it is just, I think it's an interesting place. You know, writers are always writing from a place of conflict or trying to write from a place of conflict. And to me, Waterbury is a place that has conflict just built into its DNA in the sense that, you know, as we discussed before, it's a working-class town that's in a state that is known for its wealth. And it's also a place, a working-class town, where the identity has been removed from it, and now we're trying to figure out what's going to take its place.
Yeah,
and so you have a lot of scrambling. You know, when somebody identifies as a factory worker and their work is taken away from them, it can be really jarring and discombobulating. And so I think, you know, it's not just a matter of, you know, retrain them to become a dental technician. I think there's an identity that is part of that makeup of that region that is not as easy to replace as just, you know, finding them a different job.
Yeah, I think it's probably kind of an analytic, almost psychological exercise for you to try and, you know, it's like your epigraph or your dedication to your mom. This is, you know, this is for you, not about you. And, you consciously wanted to make sure that she didn't, you know, you're writing about what Waterbury was to you. And that's why I think you might get some blowback from other people because, you know, they're not the people you're necessarily writing about. And, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes, I certainly do. you know, for me, I didn't really realize that Waterbury was a place that I would ever write about because, like I said, when I was 17, 18 years old, I really did just want to get away. And it wasn't until I was away that I was able to take a step back and see actually what is unique and interesting about a place like Waterbury. And now I actually have a great affection for it because I my issue with Waterbury when I was growing up was not that it was the most horrible place on earth, despite what, you know, Money Magazine and Forbes Magazine might have said about it. It was that it seemed so banal. It seemed like this is what everybody's life is like. And I want to live something that's more unique. And then I got away and I realized that actually there's so much that's really distinct about that region. And so it made me want to go back and spend time there.
Yeah, that's one of the things I thought about as I was reading it, and maybe why you won't be an academic librarian much longer, is that it seems so cinematic. I mean, it read cinematically, and it seems like it would be a great movie. I don't know who I'd cast in it, but it seems like it would be a great movie. I don't know if you've been approached by anybody.
I have not, but hopefully there'll be some producers listening now who take the hint.
Well, it's like I interviewed the guy, Ransom Riggs, who wrote Miss Peregrine's, and then I interviewed JoJo Moyes, you know, Me Before You, before it was even popular, and then the guy who wrote Ready Player One, and then all of a sudden I'm sitting here doing this, and they have, you know, Ready Player One directed by Steven Spielberg, and it's like,
oh, geez.
And it happens really quickly.
Well, Spielberg, if you're listening, it has not been optioned for film yet, so.
No, and plus
no, but I think, you know, what makes it, you know, when you talk about the cinematography or the cinematographic kind of element of the story, I think it's just because the place is so distinct in its character in a way that, again, it took me being away from it to really recognize. The triple-decker houses, which I thought the world was populated with, is something that I really only encounter when I go back to the Northeast.
Yeah.
The kind of the factories that are really just part of the landscape, whether or not they're actually in use, most of them are not torn down, partly because the cost of tearing them down because of the cleanup that would be involved is just too high, and so they just kind of stay there and become part of the backdrop.
It was like,
and so these are things that, you know, I actually, you know, growing up, just drove past them, never thought about them, and now being away from them, I find that when I do encounter, you know, a vacant factory anywhere in my travels, it makes me feel a little bit familiar and at home, even though it's something that people generally think of as something kind of dismal.
Yeah, I know.
It just has a, you know, a familiarity to me that is actually reassuring.
Yeah, when I grew up, I lived in the, you know, the street of row houses where all the houses were connected, and you can hear people talking in the wall next door. And then at the end of each block of row houses, there was either like an Italian restaurant or a bar with the people living upstairs. And I thought that's the way neighborhoods were, you know?
Yeah, I thought the whole world was that.
Or maybe a bakery.
It's so funny because whatever you grow up with, you think is just normal, and it's normal for the world. And that's the great thing about kind of, you know, leaving your hometown, is that you get to actually see it from a distance and say, oh, that, you know, I wasn't, everybody that lives there isn't, you know, living the pedestrian average life that I thought they were.
Yeah.
But he actually has a distinct story and a distinct character, and it just took me getting away from it to realize that.
Yeah, and that's why I was saying about it being cinematic, because you can imagine the production design, both, like, for example, the diner, you know, I can see it in my head what it would look like and see what the kitchen would look like and see them, you know, handing back the orders, the receipts, and the same thing is true, like we were talking about triple-decker houses and stuff like that. You can just imagine the production design that would go into it because you do create these images.
Well, thank you. I strive to do it because I had to think about it a lot. You had mentioned the story collection, and this isn't something that was actually explicit ever in the story collection, but when I was writing that, and it is set in Waterbury, I kind of imagined these people as all neighbors living in, you know, next-door triplexes, next-door triple-deckers. And so you're all kind of barely privy to each other's lives. You can overhear things coming from windows. Even if it's a neighbor you never actually directly engage, you tend to know more about their life than you would ever let on in a casual conversation. And that was my experience, because I did grow up in one of those triple-decker apartments. And, you know, summertime, the windows are open. You got to hear the fights. You got to hear the conversations. And you wouldn't call these people friends necessarily, but you just felt really intimate with them because of that shared space.
Yeah, we had stoops, and then I'm old enough that I remember, like, the bread truck coming up in the alleyway and the milkman and the shoe repairman. I can even remember they had, there was a gypsy wagon that came up, and they were driven by a horse, and they would come and sharpen your scissors and sharpen your knives.
Oh, wow.
And it's the same kind of feeling, you know. I thought, then, you know, and then the Good Humor Ice Cream Man would come up, and you can hear that music still, the sound of the ice cream truck. But
yeah, you still have a salivary response when you hear that music.
Well, I look forward to the next one, and hopefully Spielberg is listening. But like I said, you know, it's nice because you did compliment independent bookstores when you gave that interview on NPR, and I appreciate that, because it is a labor of love. I'm not going to make a fortune doing it.
Well, just like writing a book usually is, I know that selling them is even more so. So, I mean, I have nothing but mad love for the independent bookstores. I wouldn't know what to read if not for the recommendations.
No, the
cool
thing
is, bookstore.
Yeah, it's not like Amazon. I mean, when you go into a used bookstore, which some part of my bookstore is, you know, you're looking for a particular book, but you also see the book on either side of it, and maybe one of those books changes your life.
Serendipitous discovery. As a librarian, that's what we're looking for.
Oh, yeah, right. That's exactly right. Well, again, thanks so much for being here, and I look forward to talking to you again when your next book comes
out. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
We were talking to Jeanette Alliou, whose first novel, she had this Domesticated Wild Things short story collection earlier, which is really good, but this is her first novel. It's called Brass, and it's about the town of Waterbury, Connecticut, as we've just talked about, and it really brings home to me a lot of the... I guess growing up years for me, not only just the diner, but where I lived. And it's told, as I said, really cinematically, and it would make a great movie with two really good women protagonists, one older, one younger. So in any event, what else do we have coming up? I wrote it down somewhere here. Matt Haig is coming up. He's going to talk about his book, How to Stop Time, which is about immortality. And then Thomas Pierce is going to discuss his debut novel, The Afterlives, which is also about, in a sense, immortality. And they're kind of science fiction, they're kind of fantasy, but I read this article in the New York Times and another one in Washington Post about this spate of books about immortality. And I'll talk to each of them about what they think is the reason for that. In any event, thanks so much for joining us today, and we look forward to... having you here next week on The Avid Reader.